See how I do here, okay? Vascular and lymphatic disorders. So I want you to think about the circulation, right? We have two complete systems, correct? We have the circulatory system, the blood system, coming from the heart. We talked about that last week. We also have the lymph system. We talked a little bit about that when we talked about inflammation and infection. It is parallel to the blood system and carries everything we need to fight infection, right? So please be aware that those two circulatory systems are together. So when you have swelling, don't always assume that it's cardiovascularly based. Cardiovascular. That's a different system than the lymph system. And you know that they're parallel. They're real close to each other. They communicate in the capillary beds. So there is some communication back and forth. But be aware that there are two distinct systems. All right? So you know about blood pressure. We've been talking about blood pressure for quite a while. Right? Blood pressure does what? It's controlled by cardiac output, right? How much does a heart put out? If the heart puts out more, what's going to happen to the blood pressure? Right. It's caused by the vascular resistance, all the veins in the body, and how elastic they are. If they're hard, hardening of the arteries, if they're clogged, atherosclerosis, right? What's going to happen to the blood pressure? Exactly. So what do we do? What mechanisms do we have to counteract this or to sense this? We have hormone sensors, right? Yeah. And we have those little, what are they called? I forgot them. At different points along the vasculature to be able to sense the blood pressure. And then the hormones kick in, and those would be aldosterone and ADH, right? And what do we do then? What do those make the body do? Increase? No. Well, it might actually if needed. But we're talking about now, let's say the blood vessels are clogged or they're hard. So what are they going to, what's going to happen? What are these aldosterone systems going to do? What do you think? Yeah. What? Well, eventually, right. You're on the right track. Come on, keep talking. What's happening in the blood? Right, less fluid, right. We have systems that then take out the fluid from the blood, right? And yes, move it into the kidney and eventually it's urine, yes. So we have our own systems in our body to take care of this. Sometimes they don't work quite as well as we would like, right? And then what do people get? Hypertension, correct? But a diuretic, or how our body naturally does it, controls fluid volume, is generally the first-line hypertensive medication would be a diuretic. So let's say you're giving a diuretic and you list your diuretic on your meds. And you need to put down not just to relieve fluid or to take off fluid, but why? Are you taking off fluid because why? Okay? If it's cardiac, it's because we want to reduce the load on the heart. We want to reduce the volume of blood, correct? And therefore lower blood pressure. Because if there's not as much volume, what's going to happen to the pressure? Yeah. Got a little hole, if you got less going through it, it's going to be less, right? Okay? So we have hormones that influence it. So obviously our sympathetic nervous system stimulation, epinephrine, norepinephrine, what does that do? What happens if you stop short right before you hit a car? Right? You get this adrenaline rush. What happens to your vessels? Your vessels constrict, right? And why do they do that? Peripheral vessels all constrict, giving more blood to the core, correct? Yeah. So we have all these hormones that are working in our bodies to control blood pressure, which is great. But we also have all sorts of other factors, like the peripheral resistance, the hardening of the arteries, all this stuff. The mitochondrial contractibility, how's the heart pumping, how are all these receptors doing, okay? So blood pressure is extremely complicated. It's not like you learned over the summer, you just take the blood pressure and that's it. I want you to now think a lot more. So if you're giving someone blood pressure med, think about it. What are you impacting? Are you impacting blood volume with the diuretic? Maybe you want to increase the contractibility of the heart. Okay. Maybe you're going to talk about vascular resistance and give them a vasodilator. Right. So blood pressure is attacked medically on many different fronts. All this whole schematic. Okay. So know why you're giving the med exactly. Not just it's a blood pressure med. Okay, fine. Why? It's a diuretic. Why are we giving that instead of the ACE inhibitor? Instead of the beta blocker? Okay, what's it doing to lower blood pressure? So I'd like you, when you're working in clinical, to take that a step further. Exactly what's this doing? This is a nice chart to kind of refer to. Okay, it's doing that. Oh, yeah, that's why. Letting the vessels dilate. All right, that makes sense. If the vessels dilate, we're going to lower the blood pressure, right? Or no, it's going to take off volume. That makes sense. Okay, less blood volume, less blood pressure. It's going to make the heart work a little slower. No, okay, that makes sense. Slow down the heart, get a steady rhythm. That's going to make sense too. Okay? So I want you to take your thinking further than that. And that's why with medicating for blood pressure, you may often see 2, 3, 4 meds, right? Have you seen that when you're doing your meds? Yeah. Because we don't prescribe one thing for blood pressure. If it's not working, we don't take it away. We stack them. Because look at all the factors that can go into it. So if just taking more fluid off of your blood doesn't do it, it's probably doing something with that, but you need more. So we add something that's going to hit you somewhere else. It's going to increase the contractibility, make the vessels go larger too. Okay, and then we're going to do this. So we do all different things, put them together to hopefully control the blood pressure, which is why you see your patients on so many different meds for blood pressure. Most blood pressure is primary hypertension. Meaning what? What's primary, generally? What's that phrase mean in medicine? You know? No known cause. Okay, it is a problem unto itself. It's not secondary to anything. All right? Like if I have a occluded renal artery, let's say, and then I have high blood pressure, that would be secondary hypertension. Primary is basically, we don't know exactly what causes it. So primary hypertension is the majority of diagnoses of hypertension. We don't know the exact cause. It may be atherosclerosis. It may be an infected kidney, not taking off enough fluid. It may be stress. We're not real sure. Or it could be a lot of those things altogether. But as you know, anything over 140 systolic and 90 diastolic is considered hypertension. And we generally start medicating at that point. All right? And again, frontline is usually a diuretic. Then we go on to see what else we need to do. So what's someone with hypertension? How are they manifesting? How do they present? Often asymptomatic. Can get blood pressure pretty high and not have any symptoms. It makes sense, though, that if it got fairly high, a headache, some confusion. Correct? Yeah. Nocturia, yeah, because there's a lot of fluid. I'm trying to take off the fluid. Nausea and vomiting, visual disturbances are all things that you would see with primary hypertension. Obviously, prolonged primary hypertension, you can get cardiovascular problems, neurologic problems, renal system problems, because it's just taxing on the body in general. Having a high blood pressure over a sustained period, which is why we medicate. The studies have shown over and over and over again that it's so much better to keep everything in homeostasis rather than let really anything in the body get out of line, because it stresses the rest of the body systems. Remember that the body likes to maintain homeostasis, so if something's not working right, something else is going to compensate, correct? Okay? So the body's constantly doing that. Secondary hypertension, we can pretty much pinpoint what the problem is. Commonly kidney disease, core arcation of the aorta, endocrine disorders, common, right? Drug use, pregnancy, all very common reasons for someone to be hypertensive. Then we can treat the kidney disease, can't we? Okay. We can treat the disorder. We can see what we can do about the drug use, right? And that hopefully will lower the blood pressure. Hypertensive crisis. What is this? What's hypertensive crisis? Anybody know? Often can lead to a stroke. Rather quickly, it can lead to a stroke. Yeah, good guess. Blood pressure gets real high, like 180 over 120. How do you think that person is going to manifest? What are you going to see in that person? What are they going to complain of with that kind of blood pressure? Headache, absolutely. Probably some confusion, right? You're going to get bursting blood vessels in the face. You're going to get the popliteal kind of look in the face. Blurred vision, restlessness, sensory deficits, all make sense, right? Why might blood pressure go up suddenly like this? Any ideas?
Stress.
A stroke?
Stressful.
Maybe. Yeah, stressful event.
Clot,
very common. A thrombi of some sort. A partial. So yeah, they're still getting some, but somewhere it's causing the rest of the system to back up. Okay? Yeah, very common. And so yes, that's why it's commonly followed by, can be followed by a stroke if it's not relieved. Headache, confusion, we said all that. How about lymphadenopathy? What is that? Simply enlargement of the lymph nodes. So remember, you've got a circulatory system carrying blood. You've got a circulatory system carrying lymph. Okay? Remember, the lymph system has nodules on it, right? The nodes. You talk about a bead, a chain of beads, right? Okay. So those nodes are going to get enlarged where? We talked about this. We talked about inflammation, infection. On me, right here, right? Right now, right here. Draining down. Because I obviously have this infection. It's now making its way down to my larynx, isn't it? Classic example. So right here, what have I got? Swollen lymph nodes. They're nice and big. That makes all sorts of sense, doesn't it? Because this is where we're fighting, the throat and the larynx as of this morning. But if I had an infection in my foot, where would we see it? Probably in the groin, yeah. You'd probably be able to feel it in the groin. You'd probably have, closer to the foot, you'd have inflammation too. But, yeah. There's lots of lymph nodes under the arm. In the axilla, lots of them. In fact, breast cancers are sometimes present with inflammation of the lymph nodes under the arms. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, very good. So the lymph system is a little different in that we're going to see the nose enlarge, right? Okay, so enlargement of lymph nodes. This can be general or localized. Localized, like in my case, where I have an infection right here happening there, right? When would it be generalized? We'd have generalized enlarged lymph nodes. Exactly, systemic. Okay, when the infection's all over. Yes. And lymphangitis is obviously an infection of the inflammation of the lymph nodes. So you can have primary lymphedema. This is unusual. It's genetic. It's when people are born with a deficient lymph system. They don't have lymph in some area or deficient lymph circulation in one area of the body. I've seen people with this, and it's fascinating. They could have like one leg that simply has a deficient lymph system. How do you think that presents? What would that look like to visualize? Could you see anything? Swollen. Why? Yeah, it can go down. The lymph can't drain. So it third spaces. Exactly like what you get when there's too much, when there's a cardiac problem, right? You get edema. Same thing. Third spacing, right? Okay. So that's what you're going to see if someone has primary lymphedema. You actually also see it in secondary, but secondary lymphedema has to do with damaged vessels. Can you think of a time when lymphatic vessels would be damaged? How would lymphatic vessels get damaged? Surgery, excellent. Yeah, how else? Surgery, for sure. How else? Trauma, sure. Severing. Think about something iatrogenic. Radiation is a biggie. Okay. So there's one population of patients that we're very careful with when we take their blood pressure. Who are they? Breast cancer survivors. We don't take the blood pressure on the side that's had the mastectomy or had the treatment for breast cancer. And that is because that side has a good chance of already having the lymph tissue damaged. When you irradiate a breast, you're going through those axilla nodes, right, that feed the whole arm. Okay. Commonly, this population of person has a deficient lymph system in their arm. Any kind of a cut, a rosebush thorn, anything could be lethal, right? If an infection started because they don't have the capacity to fight the infection because the lines of circulation are not there for the lymph. Okay. So how does that, the swelling, right? Swelling is how it presents itself. So with an infection, the lymph tries to come down and it gets stuck. It can't go back. It's swollen, stuck, and they swell. So commonly you will see people with mastectomies wearing sleeves. Have you seen that before? It's not uncommon for them to wear pressure garments like the TED hose on their arms all the time to keep the swelling down. Because just regular movement will cause the lymph to move, which is correct, but then cause it to be static in the tissue and swelling. It's called lymphedema. Common in breast cancer survivors and other problems. Yeah.
So, just as to why you wouldn't take the blood pressure on the side that maybe someone got radiation to their breast, is it because you pumping up the cuff could harm them? Or what? Why is it?
Well, because you're going to affect any lymph flow, potentially, by pumping that cuff. Okay, by putting that pressure on, you have the potential of stopping what little flow there might be. Okay? So that's why you take it on the other side. Got it? Good. We talked a little bit about aneurysms, didn't we, last time? Dilation of blood vessels occurs in aorta, peripheral arteries. We talked about the weakness in the arterial wall. Obviously, hypertension is going to be a huge contributing factor. Lots of different types of aneurysms, true aneurysms, fusiform aneurysms, circumferential aneurysms, false aneurysms, perianeurysms. So as you look at the pathology, figure out what kind of aneurysm your patient has, and it's very interesting. Dissection aneurysms can be when it's just kind of gone into the layers of the vessel. So you have swelling within the layers of the vessel itself, and that can be rather problematic. So lots of different kinds of aneurysms. They may be asymptomatic, as we mentioned before. You may have a brain aneurysm that's growing slowly. Probably going to be fine. Not under a lot of pressure. It's not big. May be able to live with it for years and years. Or you may have an aortic aneurysm that's ready to burst any time. So the degree of problems of aneurysms is huge. Sometimes we just leave them. They're small. They're not going to rupture. Sometimes it's an emergent problem, depending on where and how large. Obviously, they're associated with hypertension. Because what happens if we increase the tension in the vessel? What's that going to do to a weak spot? It's caused it to pooch out, right? If it gets too much, it's going to rupture. So very important in this population of patients to maintain control over hypertension. And again, we might not know people even have an aneurysm. It can be asymptomatic. They do present. Also know that aneurysms don't necessarily rupture, just like, and cause a lot of pain. They can leak, causing pain in the mid-abdominal region or back if it's an aortic aneurysm. Just these leaky aneurysms. Great. Now what might we see? A decrease in blood pressure, right? Yeah, and some pain. Again, watch for these things. Thrombi can embolize, right? I mean, they can break off and become traveling within the bloodstream. They can cause hemorrhage, hypovolemic shock. They can lead to death. We talked a little bit about that. Thrombi often develop with embolisms. You can get popliteal, femoral aneurysms. You know that they can happen in most vessels. So you're not limited. So angiogram from a popliteal aneurysm, kind of cool. An aortic dissection is life-threatening. That's a tear in the artery. And it allows the blood to dissect or split the vessel wall. So now the blood is inside the wall of the vessel, splitting it. And there are a couple different kinds of those. All right, so be aware that there is such thing as an aneurysm that's within the walls, splitting the vessel itself in the walls of the vessel. And they can rupture as well. Sudden excruciating pain. Of course, you're going to get faintness. Why are you going to get syncope? Why? Blood flow is not making it to the blood, but to the brain, correct? Weakness, absolutely. Absence of pulses, yeah. It's not making it all the way to the peripheral, is it? Not enough blood, okay. Let's see, what else? Another picture. Peripheral vascular diseases. We've talked a little bit about this before in connection with other things. Peripheral vascular diseases can be arterial or venous, right? So how are they going to differentiate in presentation? Any ideas? Say that again. Differentiate between. Okay, which one?
I think.
Think about it. About it, you've got, if it's an arterial problem, you can't get blood down. So then what are you going to see? Cold, no hair, right? Okay, no edema. Because you can't get the blood there, right? No pulses or minimal pulses. Okay? So that's arterial. So if it's vascular, what are you going to see? You can get the blood there, but it pools. You can't get it back up. Then you're going to see the swelling, the ruddy brownness. Yeah, that kind of problem. I have some pictures later that we'll look at. Okay? So kind of be conscious of what the pathology is. The vascular problems the problems with the veins have to do often with the veins have valves, right? Okay, because of obesity, stress, overuse, those valves become really flimsy. They're little tricuspid valves, and if they don't hold together well, or they don't close, it's not going to allow the blood to come back up. Like the Walmart ladies, you know, in the carts, with the elephant legs, you know the ones, right? You know what I'm talking about, right? With the real red swollen legs. You've seen them, they're always in Walmart every time you go. Okay, that's a vascular problem. Got it? Okay, that blood is pooling in their legs. It's worse when it's dependent, meaning down like I'm sitting here. Because the blood can like pool, like when they're sitting in those carts. So what are you getting? You're getting swollen, elephant-looking legs that are kind of red, right? Yeah. Now, if that was an arterial problem, they'd be thin, no pulses, white, and hairless. Got it? Okay, just think about what's going on. And then you can see, what? You did, yeah. No, you were right. You had it. Okay, what? Why do we get some cramping in, particularly when there's an arterial problem? No what? No oxygen issue. Yeah. Like, same thing when you run and you have a muscle cramp. What are the cells doing? Working anaerobically, buildup of lactic acid, same deal. So if you have a vascular problem, you're going to have cramping because you're not getting the oxygen to the muscles. Same deal. Cells are going to respond by only working anaerobically. Hence the buildup of lactic acid and the cramps. Okay. Elevating the legs, always with these people, keep the legs up. In fact, all of us, when you're working after you've been on clinicals all day, please sit down and put your feet up that evening, all right? Definitely. Whenever you sit down, put your feet up. It's a nice habit because we are very much at risk as nurses. Let's see. We said this, toenails thickened, the whole thing. Okay, continued problems with not getting oxygen with an arterial problem. What eventually happens? There's no oxygen. They get gangrenous, right? And what population are particularly susceptible to this? We've talked about it.
Diabetics,
right? Because their peripheral circulation is so poor. So the worst comes worse, you get gangrene, and that's when we start removing toes. Okay, get sepsis. Let's see. There's some other diseases here we can talk about. Berger's disease. It's an occlusive vascular disease. Inflammation spasms causes clots in small to mid-sized peripheral arteries. Another problem you may see. Naturally, these are arterial, so how are they going to present? It's an arterial problem, so what are you going to see? Thin, shiny skin, right? Yeah. Malformed nails, pale digits, cyanosis, weak peripheral pulses. And if ever these people get any kind of a sore, it's going to get really bad and turn into a painful ulcer, right? And eventually gangrene, because if there's no blood supply, there's no oxygen to nourish the cells, and they're going to die. Right. Raynaud's disease, that's kind of interesting. Let's see, where is it? Here it is. It's called the blue and white disease. Okay. Often secondary to another disease or condition where the vessels spasm and then they don't work well. I have a picture of it that's good. Where is it? Come on. Nope. So you can see that there's spasms going on in the little vessels in those parts of the hand. So if you were to touch these two hands, you'd find a large difference in temperature, right? Because there's no circulation here. Caused by them spasming, and therefore if the vessel's spasming, it can't carry blood. Right? Kind of interesting, I think. Acute arterial occlusions, generally a problem caused by an embolism, right? An emergency condition, a pulmonary embolism, a cardiac embolism. And we've talked about that. You've heard about those. Venous thrombus, a clot that forms on the wall of a vein. Okay? Not uncommon. Causes inflammation in the vein, sometimes, generally, some obstruction to the flow, to the venous flow. There are some examples of some thrombi. And common spots of problems. It's kind of cool. See, the only part it's affected is right here. Collateral circulation has obviously come in and allowed that lower part of the foot to be, of the leg, to have some circulation, right? Because remember we talked about when there's a blockage, the collateral circulation takes over. So the blockage is here, it stops here. But at this point, the collateral circulation is taken in it, and so the rest of the leg is nourished. So that's not uncommon to just have a part. Chronic venous insufficiency, inadequate venous concern, return over a prolonged period of time. The most common cause is a deep vein thrombosis. Now, venous stasis, meaning the blood pools, the vein is not able to carry it back up. It's venous stasis, all right? And that's impairing the arterial circulation, too. If it just goes down and pulls, doesn't come back up, doesn't get back to the heart to be able to be pumped again. And you get all sorts of ulcers. Varicose veins? Anybody have any experience with those? Yep. Does it? Oh, be very careful then. They tend to be familial. Yeah. be really careful to start wearing those compression hose right now. Truly, I'm serious. Again, you've seen these at Walmart, right? Irregular torturous veins. Generally, it's incompetent valves. Same thing. The blood can get down. It just stays in the veins. It won't move up. Commonly, you see them in the legs. And yes, it tends to be familial. Pregnancy can be a really hard on people that tend to get varicose veins. People that stand are at risk, like nurses. So we need to take care of ourselves. So let's just review some of the risk factors for primary hypertension. Aging, obviously. Race. Which race is more likely? What is the stats? African Americans, very good. Family history. Now, family history, is that genetic? Probably not. It's more probably maybe how they deal with lipids, so they tend to build up plaque. Possibly it's eating habits, right? High-fat diets, smoking, could all be kind of family history. Sodium, low potassium, that kind of thing. Insulin resistance, type 2 diabetics, yeah, definitely they go hand in hand. As do alcoholics, people under a lot of stress. We talked about hypertensive crises, right? Okay, and we talked about aneurysm, all sorts of different kinds. Hypertension is definitely a precursor. Any kind of necrosis and any problem. Males, advancing age, pregnancy, congenital defects of the valve, okay, any of these things. Peripheral vascular diseases, diabetes for sure. Yes, they have poor peripheral circulation. Hypercholesterolemia. Yeah, because they're going to... Why people with hypercholesterolemia? They're going to tend to form plaque, right? Yeah, absolutely. And that's going to cause a constriction of the vessel, therefore disease. Hypertension, cigarette smoking. Okay. Let's see what else. Renal's disease, that's genetic. Embolisms, we know about those. What else do we need to talk about? Venous thrombosis. We're hormone replacement too. Chronic venous insufficiency, we learned about that. Aging, prolonged standing, please. Absolutely. So we are at risk as nurses. They make great anti-embolism stockings for nurses, support hose. You can get them in like knee highs. They have them for men. They come in black. Anybody who stands, truly, should be concerned. Let's see how we're going to manage this. Here's a whole list of medications used for hypertension. So if you get any of these drugs, don't think they're just working on the heart. Because they are working on the heart. The reason your patient's taking them may be hypertension, not a cardiac problem per se, all right? But we want to lower the blood pressure. So you may have any of these. And it says, when you look it up, yeah, it's cardiac, but also for hypertension. So be aware of when you say, what are the implications for your patient? Why is your patient taking that med? Lifestyle changes, obviously, we know all those. Here's some good nursing diagnoses. Ineffective health maintenance, risk for noncompliance, imbalanced nutrition, excess fluid volume. Yeah, very true. We talked about hypertensive crisis, aneurysms, risks, drugs, some nice nursing diagnoses. Okay. What else? I want to kind of save my voice here, guys. Medications used for chronic venous insufficiency. And your nursing diagnoses. Teaching, post-op care. All right, how about an exercise? A little project for you. Oh, yeah. You can think a little bit, okay? And you can talk to each other. So tell me, if this presentation that is described here is venous or arterial, and we'll talk about it. We talked about it. all look so tired. Underlying causation for any of these problems? No, bottom line, in any of these problems that you've brought up? No? Oxygen. Oxygen carrying capacity. Right? Period. Okay? And yes, that can happen because of surgery, because of deficient red blood cells, because of alterations in the structure of the red blood cells. Right? So, what lab test do we look at? Hemoglobin and hematocrit, H&H. What's the difference? No, neither is blood volume. Actually, both kind of works.
The amount of
exactly. Can you say that?
The hemoglobin is the protein on the red blood cells that binds to the oxygen that the red blood cells can carry, and it determines whether the red blood cells you have, the percentage of hemoglobin will determine how much oxygen.
Oxygen. That's the point. Hemoglobin has to do with the oxygen carrying capacity of the red blood cells. Each RBC can carry 4 molecules of oxygen, right? Okay? Good. Excellent. What's hematocrit? Of? The number of red blood cells. Now we're talking percent. Okay?
I'm sorry, what was the other one?
Oxygen carrying capacity is hemoglobin.
Okay.
Think of the O, oxygen carrying oxygen, versus hematocrit, which is how many red blood cells. Okay? So now, let's take a case where there are lots of red blood cells, but they're not carrying oxygen. Who's that? An example. Lots of red blood cells, but they're not carrying oxygen. No? It's iron. We need iron to make red blood cells.
It's like the red blood cells are like 2 molar
distinct. Sickle cell. Sickle cell. We've got lots of red blood cells, but they're not carrying oxygen, right? So for that patient, what's the hematocrit going to be?
Normal.
What's the hemoglobin going to be? Okay, got it? But now you have a patient that's gone through surgery. They've lost a lot of blood. What's their H&H going to look like?
Low
for both, right? They don't have the cells. Got it? Some with iron deficiency, they're not making the red blood cells. Because in order to make a red blood cell, you need all the parts. Okay? So if you can't make a red blood cell, you're not going to have enough capacity to carry the oxygen or the numbers. They're both going to be down again. Okay, let's take that a little further. Your patient from surgery, we give them a couple units of blood. Okay, so what have we done? We've increased both hematocrit and hemoglobin, haven't we? Which is why they talk about Lance Armstrong, how he used to actually infuse himself with his own blood. Like when he was resting between races. What would that do to you?
Free oxygen.
Yeah. Way to go, right?
Illegal.
Absolutely. But when I was hiking after him, I was thinking, God, if I could have an infusion of my own blood, more oxygen, that'd be awesome. Right? Yeah, it's very illegal, but apparently that's what he did. Makes sense. What would that do to your capacity to compete? I was doing that for
you.
Any time.
But it's not illegal if you go up and train on a mountain. And
okay, let's talk about that. What's going to happen then? But he was injecting himself in his own blood. Okay, but what happens if you train in the mountains?
You get higher production.
Talk about the whole to do
with
it.
You have more oxygen, so it produces more red blood cells.
Actually, you have less oxygen.
Less oxygen, which makes your body work harder, producing more red blood cells,
increasing the oxygen. Nation capacity for that altitude of less red blood cells. I mean, less oxygen. You come down to sea level.
And you have a lot more red blood cells and more oxygen. It's basically doing the exact same thing,
then injecting yourself away, except it's gene. Right. It takes 3 days, too. Okay? Where you can just get an injection of your own blood, and that's like a couple hours. Okay, got it? Got the difference? So let's take your surgical patient. We give him some blood. Okay? So now they're, okay, they've got enough hemoglobin, right? Their hematocrit's looking good, but we keep giving them fluids, all right? So now they're overhydrated. What are their H and H going to look like? No, it's both going to be. If they're overhydrated, everything's diluted. So the number of red blood cells is going to look lower. Although, and the number of, the percent of hemoglobin is going to be okay, because the oxygen carrying capacity is still good. But we don't have as many red blood cells. But that's really not true, because they're simply overhydrated. Okay? So there are some times when you're going to get false readings. Like if they're, you're not getting it, right?
No.
Okay, so if you have a whole bunch of particles, and you add a whole bunch of water to them, they're going to be dispersed.
Oh.
They're going to be diluted.
Okay.
So the hematocrit is going to show.
Because it's just the overhydration that's showing.
Right. And so all the labs are going to be what? Across the board, if someone's overhydrated, what are the labs going to be?
Low.
Conversely, if someone's dehydrated, what's going to happen?
High.
So you have your person that is from surgery. We don't give them much fluid. We don't give them any blood cells. Their hematocrit may look great because they're concentrated because they don't have that much fluid, right? And in reality, they have a problem. So you have to, the point here being, take everything into consideration. All right, don't just look at the labs. Look at why. It's low, but yeah, maybe because there are fluids. They've been on fluids. Everything's low. Looks like a case of overhydration and dilution. Conversely, they're dehydrated. All the lab values are high. Yeah, that makes sense. All the lab values are concentrated. So why do you think about blood in that matter? Blood is like the stream carrying the fish. If you have the stream carrying the fish, then a whole bunch of water from the stream, the fish are tighter packed together, right? Okay. If it snows a whole bunch, the snow comes down, it melts. If the stream goes up, the fish don't get each other at all, do they? There's much less and less fish. Got it? So that's how our cells are moving in the blood. So think of that. That's what we've got. We've got streams and fissures of cells. Okay? So think about that as we talk about anemia. Anemia, we talked a little bit about it. Pallor, right? Obviously. Yes, ma'am.
I just have a cough drop
in
my
first cough drop. Thank you. I have a cough drop too. But I'm afraid that if I take the cough drop, I might breathe in because I can't get enough oxygen, and I'm going to choke because thank you, that's very sweet. But I thought that's what I thought against the cough drop because I'm afraid I'm going to aspirate it. Because I have to breathe really deep. Because why do I have to breathe really deep? Right, because I probably have a lot of constriction here and I'm not getting well oxygenated, so I'm having to like overbreathe too. And I'm using up a lot of my good oxygen talking rather than oxygenating myself. So we'll just finish this and then you'll do a project. I'm gonna have to talk. Okay. Anemia can be asymptomatic. You're really gonna see it in the skin. Any chronic anemics here? Good. Tell us about it. How's your energy level?
I drink a lot of coffee. It's hard because I've always been a little
Are you pretty athletic? Do you run?
Yeah,
that's a problem. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sure it attributes to it. No, that's a problem. Yeah, I'm sure it attributes to it, yeah. Because you're using it all the time. You're using up a lot of oxygen.
Yeah, I take iron sometimes, but it's never really that much.
Wait until you get pregnant, it's going to be awful. And what other manifestations do you have?
I've always been like this.
Yeah, general fatigue, right? Because what's happening on a cellular level?
Not enough oxygen.
Yeah. All around? Mm-hmm. Tend to have higher heart and respiratory rates. Like right now, I'm sure my heart rate is faster. Why is that?
Working harder,
trying to oxygenate everything, right? She's not breathing well, okay? Well, then you better pump harder to get the oxygen around, right? Yeah. Okay, tissue hypoxia can cause angina, fatigue, headache, dizziness, vision. You've probably never gotten that bad, but it could, absolutely. Simply not enough oxygen in the red blood cells caused by all the things we talked about, okay? But basically, simply not. Young women tend to, menstrual periods, we lose blood. Another problem, right? Not good. And you couple that on top of someone who's chronically anemic. So yeah, iron pills. What else can you do to help yourself, Bethany?
There's iron foods, I
guess. Meats. Yeah.
Hydrate.
Yes. Absolutely. Yes.
Is it true? My friend told me that she got anemia from being a vegetarian and not getting.
Right.
She screwed herself over when she still
has
it, even though she's not a vegetarian anymore.
Right. It takes 120 days to build a red blood cell. Okay? It's a long time. So if she's not giving herself all the building blocks for a red blood cell, they're not going to get built. And that's a complex combination of proteins that are derived from, mostly from meat in us omnivores. So you have to be extremely careful if you don't eat meat to make sure that you have all those enzymes, all those proteins together to build red blood cells. And yeah, many people are challenged by it, particularly if they're vegan, you know, and it's really difficult. Yeah, and yes, she probably is. It takes a while to make up for it because of how long it takes to make a red blood cell. So if she wasn't making any or very few for several months, was that the case?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, she's still catching up. It's going to take her body a while. Is she still tired?
Yeah. She's really, gray on her
head. Oh, really?
And,
she must have done really poorly at handling her diet.
Yeah.
Definite problem, but it doesn't mean it can't be done. It can be done very well with legumes and nuts and, some vegetarians still eat eggs. I mean, it can be done very well. I don't know. For me, I would have to, study it and... It would be just way too much effort. But people do very well being vegetarians, yeah.
It is reversible.
Mm-hmm. She just needs more red blood cells, so she can carry more oxygen. And that's her problem. And that's why she's symptomatic, the tiredness, the pallor, simply from the lack of oxygen, lack of numbers of red blood cells, therefore not the ability to carry oxygen around. Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, B12 deficiency anemia.
It's like really a problem with meat, especially only in animal products.
Yes.
B12.
Yes.
So you can't get it anywhere unless you take it as a supplement.
Right. That's why if you're going to be vegan or even vegetarian, it takes so much work. Really.
Because there's no B12 in meat.
There's no what?
B12 in meat.
I think it's only in animals, isn't it? Unless you take supplements. Well, you can. There is a supplement. But you have to take them, you know. Yes, ma'am.
Is that the one that they
Yeah, it's pregnancies and anemia. It is correct. Yes, that's the one. Good. You're going through the whole lecture. Keep talking. It's great. Okay. Iron deficient anemia. We talked about that, right? What is this word? We looked that up earlier. It's swollen swollen lips and cracks on the sides of the mouth. Lips of sky skin. Pica. What's pica? Ashley's going to tell us. You talk now. Pica. What's pica?
Like the dirt paste or something,
or the chalk, or whatever. Yes, she's correct. Say it again.
It's something in, it's like a mineral, I think, or something in dirt
that's often. Yeah, they tend to eat weird stuff. People often have pica when they're pregnant. They eat things like starch, chalk, freezer ice, dirt. Yeah. And it happens with iron deficient anemia. And yeah, the thought being that there's something they're missing. Okay? B12, talked about that a little bit, right? Folic acid anemia. And yeah, different kinds of anemia. We've seen different kinds of things. We talked about sickle cell. So sickle cell, you know about the genetics of it, right? Classic Mendelian, autosomal recessive. Okay? Punnett square, you remember... Remember that with the recessive and the dominant genes? Yeah, okay. So the problem is in the microcirculation, the cells are sickled shaped. Being sickled shaped, not only do they not carry oxygen, there's another problem with them is that they clump. All right? And that can lead to a sickle cell crisis. So when they clump, what do you think they do? It says right here. Occludes. Includes the vessels into tissue ischemia, right? And then, okay, so then say a muscle isn't getting oxygenated, what's it going to do? Yeah, it's good. Well, first it's going to be really painful, right? And usually there's not quite enough occlusion to cause it to die, but usually the pain is amazing. So the sickle cell crises that you hear are immense pain. And my, do you have something to say? Oh, and my best story about that is, and one of my sons had his fifth grade end of the year party. The students all went on this place where they had slides and swimming things. This lovely little girl was not, I'm saying, why is that kid in the corner? Say, oh, her mother won't let her participate because she has sickle cell. Like, oh, that's so sad. So I came back in the afternoon to bring my cookies. This is when I dropped off my boy. I came back to bring my cookies at noon. And the little girl was in the corner. Now she looked awful. I said, is that child okay? Does she need something? You know, I'm the nursing student at that point. So, she said, I remember because I was in nursing school learning about this. And the teacher said, oh, no, she went down the slides and she's been playing all day and now she's in all sorts of pain. Her mom's coming for her. So what did that child do? She stressed herself, right? She didn't have enough oxygen to do what she needed to do. That the sickle cells were predominant. They clumped, causing tissue ischemia and causing all sorts of pain. Right? What do you think the treatment is for that child? Well, ideally, yeah. And we do transfuse at times. We hydrate big time. Because we want to overhydrate. Okay, because we want to break up those clumps so that we get all that blood back in. Because remember, the heart's okay. We want to break up the clumps and then treat the pain. That's about it, yes. Well, yes, I suppose you could say that, but we're not thinking of it like a thrombi. Because generally it's not completely occlusive, and neither does it break off from somewhere. It's just a bunch of cells get together and cause some restriction of the blood flow. That might be a better way to put it. Because she was still getting blood flow, and they generally do. I haven't seen it completely occlude a vessel. but enough to cause a decrease, a further decrease in oxygen and pain. So that's the sickle cell crisis, which can be very good. Yeah. So it's very sad. And you know about the genetic stuff. Remember that, Punnett square, 25% chance, right? And many people carry it and aren't even aware of it. Here's all the stuff. Long-term, they have renal insufficiencies, enlarged liver and spleen, that makes sense, right? From dealing with the discarded red blood cells, they also tend to get gallstones. Thalassemia. Anybody know anything about this? It is in every single hematologic lecture I've ever seen. And I've never, ever seen it in a history. I've never heard anybody have it. Does anybody know anything about it? It's apparently a genetic blood disorder, predominantly in southern Europeans, Mediterranean area, a lot of those of Jewish, from the Jewish culture. Again, I have never seen it. So if you see somebody with it, I'd love to hear more about it. But that's about as far as we're going with that. We talked about sickle cell anemia. Okay, talk about that. Folic acid anemia, yeah. Sickle cell, we're not getting anywhere. I think, there we go. There are different kinds of anemia, okay? A glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase anemia. This is going to cause jaundice and pallor, an elevated reticulocyte count. Reticulocytes are baby red blood cells, okay? So these blood cells, if the big ones die off, the little ones are going to start thinking they need to produce a whole bunch more, so you're going to see a high elevated reticulocyte count, okay? Aplastic anemia. We have lots of different kinds of anemia here. And basically, you're going to get pretty much the same thing. Cytopenia. Dizzy headedness. Weight loss. Night sweats. Myelomas. Neutropenia. All right. Rapid bone destruction leads to hypercalciasemia. Infectious mononucleosis. Okay. I think that's about it. I have another project for you, and you guys can talk as I start. Much healthier, right? Look at some of these very cool nursing diagnoses, too, because they're good. What's that? Bone marrow. Yeah, bone marrow lysis. Okay. Let me turn off this and get you your project. Much healthier. Me. Say this.